Bhagavato Arhato Samma Samputasa Buddhang Dhammang Sankhang Namasami. So, here we are again. It's always good to be here. I took my mother to the eye doctor yesterday. So I got so busy. So this eye doctor just got a new office. Shares it with another doctor. Much bigger space than the previous office, and quite a lot of space in the waiting room. There were people standing. The waiting room was so full. And this guy was just running back and forth, dealing with patients. And then there's a guy sat beside me who looked, most of the people there are over 70, most with macular degeneration, I think, some few injuries, but there's one guy that sat down beside me, he looked about 40, and he couldn't believe all these people in here, and he sits beside me, and he's got this blackberry? Blueberry. Blackberry, and he's so restless, and he's kind of, then I was like, what's he doing? Solitaire or something. And he's just so restless. And then downstairs, after Mom had seen the doctor downstairs, and I had phoned my brother, and I was waiting for him, and this guy had phoned whoever he was waiting for, that person. And he's on the phone, and he's phoning a person. The person's not there. He leaves a message. He's phoning again. He has a sense of the mind, which is just needs stimulation and needs to do things and needs to whatever. So unpeaceful. So unhappy, but the guy didn't look unhappy, and he seemed kind of successful, but just the mind always doing. Because the monastery is one of the things that we have the opportunity to do is we're given the opportunity to develop the reflective mind, and this is a capacity that all human beings have. And it's a kind of mirroring capacity, isn't it? Just like if you're going out to the symphony and you got your best outfit on, and you look in front of a mirror, and you make sure your hair looks okay and your tie is on straight or whatever, your frock. So you see yourself, don't you? You see yourself in the mirror, and that's what this witnessing reflective capacity that we are given the opportunity to cultivate. This is what we're doing. We're not only functioning in the world, we're seeing how we function. We're not only talking with each other and or just watching the breath or whatever, we're seeing how we watch the breath. We're seeing what our inner world is like and how we are responding and reacting. And without that reflective capacity, human beings are simply victims of circumstance and just subject to the whims of fortune or misfortune, or just creatures of habit, and they're not really free. They might be politically free, they might be economically successful, but they're not really free. So this is the real basis of this teaching and this practice, is this capacity to reflect, to notice life, to see how things are. Not a big thing, but when I notice people who aren't into Dhamma, a person will just indulge in anger, indulge in a mood, indulge in wrong speech, and not see the consequences of that, and then wonder why they're unhappy. Why am I unhappy? And on, say, this period of time, a long retreat, there is a golden opportunity to really hone that reflective capacity. And that's not seeking any kind of particular experience, but it's developing the capacity to witness, to experience. So it's a capacity, a skill, and a strengthening of that, and a deepening of that, that a retreat allows us to do. And of course we're trying to do that all the time. And that capacity is not, it's not just simply limited to the cushion, but because our life is so uncomplicated and so slow in relationship to the pace of urban life, that this reflective capacity can be cultivated. Most of the things we do. So we're very fortunate that way. As we contemplate and reflect on our life and our intentions and the choices we make and the habits that come up, we also employ the teaching, don't we? We use the teaching to specify that reflection, to focus that kind of reflective mind on certain aspects of consciousness. That's why we have a teaching. Otherwise, we could just be, we might notice things. Notice things happening, but we might not have any avenue to understanding. So the teaching gives you a pathway to understanding, because it says, look in this way. Look at how this happens, or look at the consequence of that. Or look how it really is, as opposed to what you might think it might be. So a teaching helps us to look where it's fruitful to look. Helps us to ask questions which are edifying. Helps us to ask the right questions. We can ask all kinds of questions, but are they edifying? Are they helpful for the liberation of the heart? Or are they just questions because people ask questions? If I'm teaching sometimes and the person asks me some kind of abstract question about, and I know they're not really coming from their mind or their heart, it's always so boring. Abstract question about karma or whatever, and you think, well, you're not really reflecting on the nature of your mind. You just want more information. You just want to have a better discussion, or you're just kind of curious. So our questions are about our own heart and about our own experience, and so they come from that reflective mind, and they come from that kind of witnessing capacity, and the teaching helps us in that way. And so that the teachings always point to the same kinds of themes, and the basic theme is basically non-attachment, of letting go, of not suffering, of non-grasping, and that's phrased in so many ways. And you hear this until your ears fall off, because we tend to forget, don't we? We kind of know that we've read it, we've seen it, but we get caught up. And we get caught up because of delusion. So that reflective capacity needs to be honed, and that insightful capacity, which comes from reflection and the teaching, that gets better and better as we just observe through the teaching. When we contemplate the contents of our experience, and we witness to our own psychological makeup, our own bodily experiences, our own social experiences, we have a kind of personal identity with that, and the teaching is trying to break down that personal identity and asking us to look at it in terms of functionality, in terms of the khandhas, right? So that's a big step, to move away from taking things personally to seeing things as natural functions, natural movements in consciousness. So say the difference between witnessing to sickness and being a sick person. Ajahn Pusala and I were talking about this just now. The difference between witnessing to the symptoms of cancer, flu, an ingrown toenail, whatever it is, that, just a simple natural occurrence of pain and discomfort and so on, and the other is being a sick person, taking on the persona of a sick person. The extreme would be a hypochondriac, or someone who feels sorry for themselves, or someone that worries. So not only are there the symptoms of sickness, there's also the symptoms of delusion, of self, of me, and my sickness, and all the worry, and all the that takes on. And that's the difference between attachment and letting go. Sickness is sickness, it is as it is. Symptoms are as they are. They're painful, they're unpleasant, and so on. And something needs to be done about them, so you go to the doctor and such like. But the whole creation of a personality around the sickness, that we can witness to and that we can let go. So one of the contrasts to this whole sense of personality is teaching on anatta. And that leads you to the insight into emptiness. Emptiness is used in different ways, I think, in the different Buddhist traditions. But in Theravada, emptiness is when the mind isn't, when attention isn't preoccupied or addicted to or deluded by this personality view. It's empty of that. You can see that in a moment where I have a symptom of something, of sickness, and then my mind takes off into some kind of worry, and I haven't seen the doctor and so on, and then I say, oh, but it just feels this way now. Or someone, I say, like, if you're with a person who happens to be toxic. I was talking with Tarek about this in the car, where you're someone at work, or someone in the family, or someone in the monastery who just happens to be, at this moment, or much of the time, just kind of very toxic person, where you're really impacted by a person's negativity, or their fearfulness, or their cynicism, something quite unpleasant that way, but it really affects you. Yeah. So if you're practicing witnessing to these things, then you'll notice that, you'll feel that. But if you're not, then you find that the angry person you become angry. The fearful person, you become fearful. The cynical person, you become cynical. The lustful person, you become like that. Angry people do that too, don't they? You know, they kind of make us angry. Or whatever. But to actually notice the sort of toxic effect of someone that you might be affected by, and just know that it's just that. And not create a self around it is a teaching of emptiness. It's empty of any personality. Which doesn't mean it's pleasant or nice. It doesn't mean that at all. And what happens when you hold that insight and you practice with that insight and you sustain that insight, you deepen that insight, then this toxic material which you might have picked up keeps wanting to go into a sense of self, doesn't it? Me and that person. Why are they like that? They shouldn't be like that. And why shouldn't be like this? This whole creation of a self, the reflective mind, and the understanding of emptiness is a continual, but this is the way it is now. So it's a continual letting go into the ugliness or the painfulness or the unpleasantness of it, but just that. You stay with that. And if you stay with that, then there's nothing, no karma created. There is the unpleasantness, and you bear witness to it, and you're surprised at actually how quickly it might pass. The feeling of self is very permanent. Very, very, very strong. It's going to be there all the time. But actually the experience of it, well, you don't know. Depends on the connection or whatever. So you become more and more transparent. It goes through you rather than getting stuck in a sense of self being created. Emptiness. So emptiness does not imply non-feeling, right? But it is something to be remembered, because it's true. It is, that whole sense of proliferation of self is not true. It's just a delusion. There's nothing solid in it. There's no There's no concrete reality, it's simply a habit of consciousness. And so the practice of emptiness, rather than just some kind of endpoint that you come to. I give Lawrence Buddha Dharma magazine, and in that there's an article on Does Buddhism Make You Happy? And in it, Andrew Oletsky, I think that's his name, he runs the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. He kind of said some very helpful things for me, where he reminded the interviewer that, like the word nirvana, is more often used as an adjective. I think the interviewer asked, you've been nirvana'd. I said, you've been nirvanized, like homogenized or pasteurized. So the craving mind has ceased. You know, it's a cessation, you say, as an adjective. Or the word cessation, you say, it's better to see it as a verb rather than a noun. Like this thing, cessation or nirvana, right? Cessation as a verb, a practice, a doing, a process. And so quite often in the practice, when we hear these words, they sound like noun, emptiness is like a noun. Right? So I get this thing. But actually to continue practice, the non-attachment to, the non-belief in this self-sense, sakkaya ditti, a continual reflection that that's just an object, not true, and coming back to the body, say, begins this way of liberation. The mind is liberated from this toxicity, from these habits and compulsions and all of that. Not through denying them, not through getting rid of them, not through indulging in them, but knowing them as Dhamma, as something which is anatta, which is empty of self. It's a difficult concept, anatta, but you can see it operating there. There is sickness and there is me being sick and all of that. All of that associates you with. Notice, like sickness, you can be sick and you can bring up a whole train of old types of behaviors and memories, or other things, maybe not sickness. So the teaching on anatta leads to the doorway of emptiness. If you reflect and notice that sense of self which is arising with these conditions has a certain quality depending on those conditions. You're praised and a certain kind of self arises. You're insulted and another kind of self arises. You're successful, kind of a self arises. You're not successful, another self arises. Your meditation goes good. You feel all confident. Your meditation goes bad. Think it's down the tube. The senses of self that come up, they're empty. Right? And as you see them, it's just stuff. It's just soap bubbles. There's no realness of who I really am. It's not real. As that witnessing consciousness and as that that continual realization of emptiness becomes stronger, it's a doorway. It's a doorway to liberation. Right? So the reflection on anatta leads to the doorway of emptiness, and it's a doorway into liberation. Anicca. The khandhas are anicca, dukkha, anatta. So anicca is the reflection on uncertainty. So the khandhas, one of the ways you look at the khandhas is that they kind of offer signs, like warmth is a sign, and cold is a sign, beauty is a sign, ugliness is a sign, praise and blame, they're signs, and they have qualities. Qualities. These qualities are uncertain, and we should do the best to keep the shrine room nice and cozy, and so on and so forth. But the teaching on uncertainty is that all signs are dependent on causes and conditions, and that no sign is reliable. No sign is reliable. And if I become reliable on a sign, I rely on it, then when it changes, I suffer, I blame, I get angry, I get fearful, I get worried, I get depressed, or whatever. So the teaching on anicca leads to another doorway, and that's the doorway of the signless. If you're looking for a sign in the spiritual practice, beauty, happiness, success, confidence, and hence you're rejecting all the other signs, decrepitude, blame, whatever it might be, then that search for a sign keeps the mind very restless. And yet when you realize that all signs, all things, all conditioned things, all phenomena, all the khandhas, the mind-body experience, is anicca, it's uncertain, and you really contemplate that deeply, when your mind starts to go towards signs, that's not signless. Or when it rejects a sign, but if I reject one, then I have to look for the... No, it's signless. And signless is another doorway. Is a doorway to liberation. So you're in the monastery at home or whatever, and the sign that comes up is like some kind of unhappiness with whatever. Some kind of unhappiness with what someone said to you, or some confusion in the monastery, whatever it is. And then you think, well, I don't want the sign of confusion, I want harmony. I'll seek harmony. Well, that seeking of harmony, you realize, well, harmony too is a sign. It's a conditioned thing, it's a phenomenon, it's uncertain. And so that movement out into looking for signs, that movement out is kind of, can't be there, can't, no, we have, no. And there's a giving up, there's a letting go into, well, this sign, this is all right, this is just the way it is now. And the mind and the heart realizes that very knowing is signless. Right? The taste of the world has signs, it's sweet, sour and salty, bitter. That's the taste of the world. So the spiritual endeavor is not the seeking of taste. It's not a kind of, we're not trying to consume. We're not consuming experience to get a certain fulfillment from experience. We're stepping back and witnessing, this is how experience changes, it's uncertain. So the teaching on uncertainty isn't simply to leave us in a kind of shaking uncertainty, but it's to encourage us to not seek that which is uncertain, and to abide in this signless knowing, in knowing which is signless, has no sign. So the knowing of cold and the knowing of hot, it has no sign. And the mind which is looking for a sign is a restless mind, and that's where craving comes from. It seeks the pleasure, tries to get rid of the displeasure. And this, again, there's nothing wrong with that, and we need to use it like for feeding the body and so on, but as a spiritual endeavor, it's a dead end. It can't work. So there's the doorway of the signless. So if you bring up that kind of signless, not, that's the usual translation, that might not be a good word for you, but what it's implying is that the mind is just trying to get some experience. It's off base. Whereas the mind that knows this experience is change, it's the mind you can trust in, because it's not going anywhere. It's not dependent. It's not dependent on change. Anicca dukkha, anatta. Dukkha is unsatisfactoriness or not rightness or whatever. The contemplation of dukkha is and anicca dukkha anatta are around the five khandhas, right? So, around the five khandhas, that if you seek fulfillment in the five khandhas, you're always going to be disappointed. You'll always be disappointed. Even if you have some satisfaction in some way for some period of time, it will change. And because it changes, you can't hold on to it, so the sense of pleasure or satisfaction or fulfillment goes. So it's unsatisfactory. And the reflection on the unsatisfactoriness of the khandhas leads to the doorway of desirelessness. Desirelessness. Because if my spiritual life is based upon desire, what am I desiring? The only thing I know how to desire are the five khandhas. Emotional experience or sensual experience of some sort, of sound or serenity or beauty or social experience of harmony, etc. Same kinds of things. But the reflection is that it's unsatisfactory. It'll bite you, and be careful. It's not where it's at, etc. And that leads to desirelessness. So it's the same kind of doorway. Desirelessness. And that's a very powerful word. If you're practicing and you notice the sense of self come up, and you drop that, it can still be quite a strong desire to get something, like a mind which never thinks or some experience. But desirelessness, what does that feel like? Not as a kind of philosophical absolute you have to hold on to, but as a practice that you do. What does desirelessness feel like? It feels very calm. Because desire is suffering, isn't it? Attachment to desire is this restlessness. So desirelessness. So the mind throws up some kind of negative state of mind. Practice desirelessness. What would desirelessness be around this? Well, it would be acceptance. That's the way it is. So desirelessness is a doorway to liberation. And these three doorways are the kind of mirror images of the Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta teaching. And you can see how if you keep relinquishing this delusion in the I sense, in Sakaya Ditti, and you keep letting go of that, where does it take you? It takes you from the head to the heart. You kind of, where's self-centered? It's always thinking and worrying about yourself, or self-disparagement, or annoyance at someone, or all that. And it's always in thought. Yourself being created and perpetuated and generated, and then when you just let go of that, you know, your attention comes down more and more to the heart. Signlessness, like when you stop looking for something, and you just abide with the thing that is there. That knowing, signlessness. And then desirelessness, just kind of learning how to put that word into consciousness. Obviously, with the second and third noble truths, tanha, the abandonment of tanha, key to really liberating the heart. So you begin to practice desirelessness with unpleasant states of mind, with pleasant states of mind, because the desire is to have the beautiful meditations and the, you know, exquisite insights, and all the kind of seeming rubbish that we have seems wrong, but the knowing of that, it's all important. It's all very, very important. So desirelessness. And putting language into your mind which brings you to right view. Putting language into the mind which brings you these kinds of reminders of right understanding and right view. And then you begin to see where liberation really is, this process of letting go, rather than the process of getting rid of attachment, accumulating, holding on to, gaining something in the future, time, self, all of that goes on. And in that vein, you can see how all the wholesome things that we're encouraged to do in this life, like generosity, this spontaneous generosity rather than manipulative generosity, say, compassion, patience, endurance, determination. You can see how they're the basis for that kind of mind. So just the determination to sit through, like if you're practicing on your own, You're not used to practicing on your own. You're used to having a structure. And you say, well, I'm going to sit for an hour. And then your mind gets restless. Saying, oh, half an hour, that's plenty. You say, well, just to witness to that. That's just a sign. Restlessness is just a sign. And the sense of self that creates that and wants to go and do something. I need to do this. I need to do that. And just the desirelessness just feels restless. It's a determination which is not based on ego. It's a determination to reinforce the dharmic view of things. And so you sit through an hour of restlessness and just watch the desire to get away from it, to judge it, to analyze it, to just watch, just be with it. And you build a foundation for freedom. Not because it was a pleasant experience. Not because it was a kind of super samadhi experience. No, because you've abided with something with desirelessness and emptiness. So the heart is quenched, the desire, it's been nibbanized. It's been homogenized. So rather than the heart being rather than craving mind being reinforced, the capacity just to witness to something which is unpleasant or difficult leads to the peace of the mind. You have to let it happen, and that's where determination comes in. It doesn't have to be a willful kind of strictness on yourself, but just to determine, well, just be here, I'll watch this. Just be with this now. And the heart gets quenched. So why does it get quenched? Because it's practicing emptiness. You don't let it go to self-sense, it tries to. You're practicing desirelessness. You're not looking for a particular sign. Restlessness is fine. That'll do. Whatever. Right? And so the craving mind, which creates self, the craving mind which wants a sign, which believes in the khandhas as being somehow one khanda being better than the other, whatever, that craving mind is not indulged in, and you begin to see the cessation of wanting, the cessation of the whole self-sense arising, and the mind's liberated. You get a sense of the freedom of the mind. Ah, look, it's free, just there. And that kind of insight and that kind of practice is not spectacular. You know, it's just something that almost creeps up on you. And you find your mind's peaceful. Wow. And then you try to get that peace with will. No. You just let it happen. Let go. Let it take place. So on this, you know, you guys have from very Canadian. The holy members of the Sangha have. We have another month of retreat, and it's very easy to for the next month to become a kind of restless experience of getting revved up, and so unfortunately the weather is still cold, it's not springtime yet, but redetermine now, there's another month of the retreat, and you have to do that, don't you? You have to redetermine, okay, what are the priorities now? What's important now? And making determinations is a way of setting up priorities. It's not a way of beating yourself up. So even when you sit for an hour, say, make your priority the present moment. So make that very clear. Use a rational mind. So when the mind starts to go to the future or past, then you remember, no, the priority is now. The priority is now. Right? And that's what settles your mind. Being determined, but not through blind willpower. So the same with the march of this month of retreat is like if your mind starts to really want to get caught up in projects or whatever it might be, just make this the priority of non-becoming, not filling the mind, not being. I mean, there's plenty to do anyway, cleaning snow and cooking food and so on. But anything extra. Don't create things to do. Try to create things to do. So you have this wonderful opportunity to watch how the mind wants to become, wants to get born. It likes to get born. That's craving. Now notice how, like, your heart can experience incredibly deep peace, and yet it will go to craving. And if you look at the contrast between, when I look at my mind, the things that the mind gets sucked into is so uninteresting compared to the peace of the heart. But the peace of the heart, oddly enough, isn't really a function of craving. So the craving mind can be just this habitual pulling towards doing and becoming and all of that on things which are not terribly important. So Adhitana Paramita is laying the priority down at being rather than becoming, rather than doing and producing and all the rest that we do. And that's very special in our life. You don't get that. And usually people are applauded for their productivity and those kinds of things, which is good. We need to do things, but we have a chance now to just practice just knowing. This is the way it is now. Get really good at that. Get really, really good at that. All right. Leave that for your reflection.